I should drink in and always be for. Yeah, I will drink it and always be for.
All right, guys, we'll see you next week.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. on Thursday, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents, your weekly roundup of the latest limestone local news. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Coming up in today's episode, our feature story will be an advocacy-based motion supported unanimously by City Council, urging the provincial and federal governments to take steps towards a national marine conservation area for Lake Ontario, some upcoming opportunities to enjoy the outdoors, and precautions for this summer related to extreme heat and the impacts of climate change. We'll also run through your weather and traffic report for this upcoming weekend, and a few events to keep on your radar from CFRC's events and concerts calendars. Without further delay, let's dive in. Council unanimously passed an advocacy-based motion at their last meeting, requesting the federal and provincial governments take steps towards establishing a National Marine Conservation Area, or NMCA, in Lake Ontario. NMCA is a federal designation managed by Parks Canada. The designation creates smaller zones of higher protection, aimed at protecting ecologically significant freshwater and marine ecosystems, while still allowing people to use and enjoy them sustainably. They can include lakebed, water column, islands, wetlands, and coastal lands, while restricting activities like undersea mining, offshore oil and gas development, and dumping that could damage aquatic ecosystems. There are currently 5 national marine conservation areas in Canada, and Parks Canada has a goal of establishing one in each of the Great Lakes. Right now, Lake Ontario is in the site identification phase. While no formal process has been launched, Nature Canada says there's been growing interest from government officials in exploring a Lake Ontario NMCA. The motion passed by council, brought forward by Councillor Lisa Osanek, asks senior levels of government to move to the next stage of the process by undertaking a comprehensive feasibility study. That study would evaluate the environmental, economic, cultural, and social impacts of potentially establishing an NMCA in Lake Ontario. Hannah Dean, a representative with Nature Canada, came before council to outline what such a designation would mean for Kingston and the eastern Lake Ontario region. Dean spoke to what's at stake, pointing to environmental pressures facing the lake and importance of long-term protection efforts.
The Great Lakes are a vital economic, natural, and cultural resource, holding 84% of North America's freshwater supply and supplying drinking water for millions of people. The eastern basin of Lake Ontario in particular is rich in biodiversity and contains critical habitat for globally rare plants and endangered animals. A National Marine Conservation Area, or NMCA, in this region would help protect rare bird species like the piping plover, who is threatened with habitat loss, and many other migratory bird species who rely on the lake as a stopover point in their journeys. Why do we need to protect the lake? Well, there are several threats to the health of Lake Ontario. One you may be familiar with is the increase in toxic algae blooms, which can be dangerous to animals and cause beaches to close. An NMCA would bring federal funding to the region to address invasive species and invest in habitat protection and restoration. This would benefit fish populations, species at risk, and the people who live nearby. Many of you will know just how far the Great Lakes have come in the restoration, despite the many challenges that they face. Most Ontarians live around the lake. This is a system under immense pressure. An NMCA would ensure that the lake is conserved for the long term through federal investments.
According to Dean, the tentative area under consideration stretches roughly from Brighton to Kingston and includes areas in and around Prince Edward County. Nature Canada has been advocating for a Lake Ontario NMCA for several years and has already gathered significant support. Dean told council the organization plans to continue outreach efforts with municipalities along the lakeshore moving forward.
We've talked to First Nations, local community groups, historians, scuba divers. We have gathered signatures from over 50 organizations across the region in a joint letter that was sent to the province, asking them to work with Ottawa on the project. Individual citizens have also weighed in. We've had over 20,000 letters of support sent to the federal and provincial ministers calling for action. We did some polling that said that 84% of the Northern 84% said the Northern Shore is critically important for supporting wildlife and the environment, and two out of three respondents expressed support for an establishment of NMCA right here. And we're talking to city councils like you. We're asking for you to help to endorse the NMCA to protect the local community, biodiversity, economic development, tourism, and cultural heritage for generations to come.
Councillor Osanek stressed the broader significance of the motion before council voted, saying Kingston has an opportunity to take the lead.
With this motion, we are telling the province to please do a feasibility study with nature, with Parks Canada to have that, the National Marine Conservation Area in this region. So we heard that among the entire shoreline of Lake Ontario, Eastern Ontario is the most pristine. Brighton has already shown their support. I'm hoping that Kingston will show leadership tonight so that then Prince Edward County and Belleville can follow along and the province, you know, starts this feasibility study.
Councillor Vincent Shinani also spoke in support of the motion, highlighting the potential benefits for Kingston and the surrounding region.
I think that this is going to be a lot of benefit for Kingston and the area if this actually goes through. I think there'll be a lot of benefits to our community while actually doing a lot of good. So I hope that you all support this, and because I think this is like a tremendously like fantastic idea.
With that, council voted unanimously in support of asking the federal and provincial governments to begin formally studying the creation of a National Marine Conservation Area in Lake Ontario. For many local environmental advocates, the vote marks an important early step in a potential major conservation initiative in the Kingston region. As Kingston continues to prepare for hotter summers and more frequent extreme heat events, the city is now officially launching a new pilot program aimed at helping vulnerable residents stay safe indoors. In a release issued yesterday, the City of Kingston announced the launch of its new Residential Air Conditioner Assistance Program, a pilot initiative that will provide a limited number of free air conditioning units to eligible adults across the city. The program comes as municipalities across Ontario continue adapting to the growing impacts of climate change, including longer and more intense periods of extreme heat. Health officials have repeatedly warned that high indoor temperatures can pose serious health risks, particularly for seniors and people with pre-existing medical conditions. Kingston City Council first began discussing the possibility of a residential cooling assistance program earlier this spring. At its March 10th meeting, Council directed staff to research possible options for an air conditioner pilot program and return with recommendations. Then on April 21st, city staff presented a report outlining how similar programs operate in other Ontario municipalities and proposed options for Kingston. Council ultimately approved $17,000 from the city's Environmental Reserve Fund to move ahead with the pilot project, with a full report expected back in 2027. The city says the pilot program is part of broader work currently underway to strengthen Kingston's community heat response plan. That discussion is expected to continue at City Hall next month, with Council set to review the city's official extreme heat response plan in early June, as the municipality prepares for another potentially hot summer. Under the new pilot program, the city will purchase air conditioning units directly using the approved funding. To help deliver the program, Kingston has partnered with United Way, which will coordinate volunteers to help distribute and, when needed, install the units for recipients. The city says installation support is intended to reduce barriers for older residents who may not be physically able to transport or set up an air conditioner on their own. City staff will also follow up with participants later this year to evaluate the program's impact and gather information ahead of a planned report back to council. To qualify for the program, applicants must be 65 years of age or older, live within the city of Kingston, and meet the program's low-income eligibility requirements. Applicants must also live in a multi-residential building and self-declare that they were advised by a medical professional to obtain an air conditioner to help manage an existing medical condition. The city notes that no medical documentation is required as part of the application process. Applications are now open and must be submitted by June 10th at 4 p.m. Residents can apply through My Kingston or by completing a paper application at several city facilities, including Housing and Social Services, the Invista Center, the Kingston East Community Center, the Rideau Heights Community Center, and Artillery Park. Because only a limited number of units are available, eligible applicants will be entered into a randomized draw, with recipients expected to be contacted during the week of June 15th. As more people head outdoors to enjoy warmer weather, local public health officials are reminding residents to protect themselves against tick-borne illnesses. In a release issued this week, Southeast Public Health says the region is considered an established high-risk area for blacklegged ticks. Ticks can carry bacteria linked to Lyme disease, anaplasmosis, and other illnesses that can be transmitted through tick bites. Public Health says preventing tick bites, checking for ticks after spending time outdoors, and removing attached ticks quickly are all important steps in reducing the risk of infection. Kim McCann, Manager of Environmental Health with Southeast Public Health, said, quote, "The risk of encountering ticks when enjoying outdoor activities is very high in our region," end quote. McCann added that simple precautions, including using insect repellent and checking yourself, children, and pets for ticks after being outside, can help keep families safe and healthy. Southeast Public Health is recommending residents use Health Canada-approved insect repellents, wear long sleeves and pants when possible, and consider permethrin-treated clothing for additional protection. Officials also recommend showering within 2 hours of coming indoors, drying outdoor clothing on high heat for at least 10 minutes, and being aware that pets can also bring ticks into the home. Public Health says the risk of Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses begins about 24 hours after an infected tick attaches and increases significantly after 48 hours. Early symptoms of Lyme disease can include fatigue, fever, headaches, muscle pain, stiff neck, and rashes, which may not always appear as the classic bullseye shape many people associate with Lyme disease. More serious complications can include arthritis, meningitis, facial paralysis, and heart issues. Residents experiencing symptoms after spending time outdoors are being encouraged to visit a healthcare provider or pharmacist for assessment and possible treatment. Southeast Public Health also notes that people can contract Lyme disease more than once, as infection does not provide natural immunity. More information on tick safety, symptoms, and prevention is available through Southeast Public Health's website, while tick identification services are now being directed through etick.ca. Now that you're aware of how to stay safe, residents looking to spend more time outdoors this summer will soon have a chance to celebrate the lakes, trails, and natural spaces that define the Frontenac region. In a release issued today, South Frontenac Township announced that the Lakes and Trails Festival will return on Saturday, June 20th at McMullen Park in Verona. The free, family-friendly event will run from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. and is focused on encouraging residents and visitors to get outdoors, stay active, and connect with nature. According to the township, the festival will feature a mix of recreational activities, environmental programming, and outdoor education opportunities for all ages. Amanda Pantry, Recreation and Events Coordinator for South Frontenac, said, quote, "The Lakes and Trails Festival is a favorite event among many South Frontenac residents." Pantry added that the event promotes healthy and active lifestyles while also showcasing local organizations and businesses connected to outdoor recreation across the township. This year's programming includes guided kayak paddles, a guided bird walk, yoga and Pilates sessions, trail running, supervised swimming activities, and an organized dog walk. The festival will also feature live music from Pete Moss, children's activities, face painting, inflatables, nature-themed crafts, and a reptile show from Little Ray's Reptile Zoo. Organizers say additional programming is still being added ahead of the event. More information about the Lakes and Trails Festival is available through the South Frontenac Township website. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to your weather and traffic report for the rest of this week. Starting with the latest traffic updates, on Johnson Street from University Avenue to Aberdeen, expect delays for a contractor to complete storm sewer improvements until July 30th. On Bath Road between Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard and Portsmouth Avenue, expect delays as crews continue installing intersection pedestrian signals. Over on King Street West from Country Club Drive to Front Road, traffic is reduced to one lane in each direction for work by Utilities Kingston. Watch for lane shifts, reduced speeds, and shared lane signage. At the intersection of Montreal Street and John Kunder Boulevard, there will be delays due to construction until April 13th. Cranbrook Street from Days Road to Lakeview Avenue is closed from 8:40 to 9:20 a.m. and 3:20 to 3:50 p.m. every weekday as part of the School Streets program, restricting access during school drop-off and pickup times. Keep in mind these closures do not impact the weekend. Wright Crescent remains closed between Palace Road and Kingsland Crescent for roadway repairs and safety improvements. Princess Street remains closed from Frontenac to Division as part of a major reconstruction project. And finally, long-term closures remain in place on Aberdeen between Johnson and William and Barrie at Queen. Now taking a look at the weather forecast for the next few days, tonight we're expecting clear skies and a low of 11 degrees. Friday brings a mix of sun and cloud for most of the day, but keep an umbrella nearby because a few showers are expected to move in during the afternoon. Winds pick up significantly, becoming west at 30 kilometers an hour with gusts up to 60 by the morning. The daytime high reaches 22 degrees and the UV index climbs to 8. Friday night stays windy with cloudy periods and a 40% chance of showers with temperatures dropping to 10 degrees. Saturday looks like the nicest day of the weekend, full sunshine and a comfortable high of 19 degrees. Clear skies continue into the evening with an overnight low of 9. Then on Sunday, we're back to a mix of sun and cloud with a 40% chance of showers and a high of 20 degrees. Sunday night stays partly cloudy with another 40% chance of showers and a low of 9. That wraps up your quick weather and traffic report for the next few days. Now let's get back to more local news.
If I wanted to play at the next level, I probably would have had to leave Kingston, which would have been so unfortunate because everything that I love is here.
Kind of was all over because there wasn't really an option in Kingston. But now that there is, there was like no doubt in my mind that I want to come and just play for a team where I'm from and represent my city.
For the first time in a decade, Kingston has semi-professional soccer again. This spring, the Kingston Sentinels launched both men's and women's teams in the Ontario Premier League, a level just below Canada's fully professional game. And in just a few weeks, the club's early days have already started to feel like something bigger than a new team. Youth soccer has been steadily growing in Kingston for a long time, currently having over 10,000 registered players and participation growing over 40% between 2013 and 2023. However, for years, local players say there's been one major problem. There was nowhere local to go next. While there are youth programs and university soccer through Queen's University, players say the local pathway ended after that. Jacob Ball and Ian Ferguson, captains for the Sentinels men's team, and Mara Stanistreet with the women's team, all grew up playing in Kingston.
There hasn't really been much like in Kingston growing up for me to really look up to in the sense of playing at the highest level. Obviously, there's some collegiate and university options here, but something outside of that more structured professional environment, I think something that the city's lacked.
Having played on almost every team in Kingston before this, there's Kingston United, Kingston Clippers, now Junior Gales, now Atletico Kingston, KBFC, Kingston Belleville Football Club. Yeah, there was never really something like above all those other than just at the youth level.
Yeah, I feel like from a really young age, like I remember we got our OPDL license in Kingston when I was going into U13. And that was like the next big thing kind of for youth soccer in Kingston. And so we were really excited about it. But it didn't look like there was much else after that because we haven't had a League One program in a really, really long time.
And without a local team at that level, players left.
So previously, 2 years ago, I traveled out to BC to play for League One because there was really nothing in this area. And then last year, I played in Toronto with North Mississauga Soccer Club.
The League One or OPL now is kind of like the best environment for like a semi-professional, like looking for players to like play professionally, in my opinion. So when I was after my first year of college, just kind of took the step to go to Toronto, live on my own kind of thing, play for a team there. And same thing again the following year. And then this past summer, I was out in Halifax for a bit. So it kind of was all over because there wasn't really an option in Kingston.
If I wanted to play at the next level, I probably would have had to leave Kingston, which would have been so unfortunate because everything that I love is here.
This has been the case since Kingston's first OPL team, the Kingston Clippers, withdrew from the league following the 2016 season. Now, after 10 years of waiting, local players finally have the option once again to represent their hometown at the OPL level.
Now that Kingston has its own team, can stay home finally, and play for the city and allow to that growth within the city.
There was like no doubt in my mind that I wanted to come and just play for a team where I'm from and represent my city and, you know, carry that pride on my chest when I'm playing every single game, which I never really had the opportunity to before.
And for players like Nicole Doncaster, who moved to Kingston from the East Coast to pursue her master's at Queen's, the absence of that next level in the city could have ended her playing career altogether. But with the launch of the Sentinels, she was able to keep going.
I'm at a point in my life where I graduated from my undergrad in 2024, and I really thought that that was sort of the end of my soccer career. So now that we have this new opportunity in Kingston as well to continue playing and keep going through with playing soccer and doing the things that I love right where I am without having to do some long commutes elsewhere, it's been really a good time.
For Paul Barbeau, CEO of Victory Grounds Ventures, owner and operator of the team, that missing pathway was exactly what the Sentinels were designed to address, filling the critical gap between youth programming and the professional league.
This region, all of SOSA, is underutilized, both in field and turf and the next level in soccer for the players to go to. You know, we have 20 kids, young adults from Kingston that grew up in are now playing back in Kingston. Some went abroad, some went to Europe, and now they're being able to play in Kingston. So Kingston is just right because it is the center of this big growth in soccer that I feel we can tap into.
But bringing semi-professional soccer back to Kingston wasn't a simple task. The Sentinels are part of Victory Grounds Ventures' larger vision to grow the sport in the region, one that originally planned to build infrastructure before launching an OPL team, then later a professional CPL team. After deciding the initially proposed Memorial Center site for the stadium was not the right fit last year, plans changed.
We have flipped it. So, you know, team first, followed by stadium, followed by another team.
Barbeau says the change in plans has been a challenge.
One of the issues we have is part of the funding to support the operations of the team was coming from the stadium and the renting of the facility, and not having to pay rent to the city or Queens or all the other places I'm renting turf from. We have our own facility to do that. So it has increased our costs.
Still, he says the opportunity to bring OPL soccer to Kingston came at the right time.
While the timing may not have been perfect for us on that side of it, it just fit in very well into, you know, allowing us to firm out the business model.
Part of that business model depends on proving Kingston will support soccer at this level. And early signs suggest the city is responding. Even rough weather didn't stop fans from showing up for the home opener.
The opening match was great. We had a great turnout. You know, we had about 700 tickets issued. We had almost 600 people show up. You know, some to the first game, some stayed for both games, some stayed for the last game. So it was a great turnout. In our first men's home game, we had over 300 people come to the game. So, and it was cold and there was ice pellets. So, you know, I think we've got a great, just proves that Kingston is a great community to support the soccer project. And I think that's just going to grow with time as more people learn about it.
Barbeau says the organization is trying to build something that feels bigger than just another local sports team, different from previous models that can last with community support.
We're geared around bums in seats. Our revenue isn't coming from lower levels of youth programs. Our revenue is coming from bums in seats. And so we're looking to be very fan-centered and very fan-focused. You know, we haven't got the chants and the songs up yet that you would usually see in a European club, but we'll get there, and the fans are coming out supporting it and yelling and cheering when the goals get scored. You know, the kids are running around, and it's a great environment that we're trying to build, and Kingston's coming out to support that.
And so far, the players are feeling that support.
Oh, I think the support has been actually crazy. Like, it's definitely more than any of us, I think, could have thought. I remember we walked out for our home opener game and my jaw was on the floor.
Yeah.
Like, it is honestly the coolest thing ever to see people like want to be there to support you. Just everybody's excited to have semi-professional soccer in Kingston. And so we've built a pretty good community already.
You know, after the game, last game, I said that, you know, the fans make it feel like we're playing at the 12th player with the energy and like atmosphere that they bring. It's just, we work so much harder when there's people there and we don't want to let them down. We want to get them everything that they paid for in the experience itself. So it's just super motivating as a player.
For many players, becoming examples of what's possible for younger Kingston athletes matters just as much as the games themselves, especially with many current Sentinels players coming up in and staying involved in Kingston's youth soccer community.
Especially like at our games, you see a lot of kids that I coach out, and it's honestly amazing. And like to see from that age, when I was that age, I wanted to be in this position. And so to kind of show younger kids that we can do that here at home and not have to leave is really important, I think. I'm hoping that younger kids understand that there is more to soccer than kind of what they've been seeing. I know everybody kind of plays their youth soccer and then they watch the MLS, and that's basically it for them. And I think even with like the newer professional league in Canada and with the Women's Professional League in the States, there's so much more than a lot of girls understand. Even playing overseas, there's so many opportunities that I think we can really bring light to, because we have some great talent on our team, and I'm sure that everybody's going to do amazing things even after they're done with us. So
the hierarchy in Kingston, there wasn't really anything at that top where players like Ian and I growing up here could really strive towards. We'd have to go like elsewhere. And so we just want to make our city proud and give the opportunity to the kids coming up through the age groups, like the best opportunity they can to represent our city and also themselves at the highest level possible. And just overall, we want to just make our city really proud and, you know, show the kids that, you know, there is something now to work towards. And even in training, we've had some younger kids from different age groups get the opportunity to train the first team. And we really want to just show that togetherness and community where hard work is rewarded and that there are opportunities available for these children, whereas might not have been as possible before. So we just want to show them that, you know, never stop working hard and just be yourself on the field and that good things can come.
And while the Sentinels are still only weeks into their first season, ambition around the club is already growing quickly. Both teams remain undefeated in these early stages of the year. Inside the locker room, right now, promotion to the next tier in the league is the goal.
It's definitely to get promoted. I think that's first and foremost. I think that's bare minimum for us. When we talk as a team, we don't see any other way of not getting promoted. I think that's in our minds, that's the only way that the season's going to go. I think we have the ability. I think we all know we have the ability as a team. And I think if we stay connected and stay motivated and everyone is on that same path and that has that same goal, I definitely think we can do that.
I think the big goal that our coach has really nailed into us as well is that we would love to be promoted up into the next level as well, which is not the easiest path for us to get up to, but we would love and we feel like we are a team that is better than the league that we are in right now as like a League 3 team, that we can compete at that League 2 level. So to be moving up, I think overall for the whole season, that's one of our really big goals.
Yeah, and honestly, one thing that we talk about all the time is to inspire ourselves and to inspire the others on our team. That's a big one that Coach Chad has kind of drilled into our brains, that if we inspire each other and we stay inspired ourselves, we will do great things this year and we will show people that we can do great things, like Nicole was saying. We are a team that should be competing at the League 2 level, and I think we fully have the ability to get there, but I think the biggest part is to inspire ourselves and the people around us.
And confidence around the team is growing quickly with ambitions not only of promotion, but of changing how Kingston soccer is viewed across the province.
We've had a good start to the season so far, but even right now, you know, we're not settled for like satisfaction. It's like two wins being at the top of the table. We want to keep on going game by day and really show Ontario and Canada who Kingston is as a soccer club and also as individuals. So just training hard every single day, never satisfied, and working towards, you know, making our city as proud as we can.
There's definitely more to come within the community. I think it's continuing to grow. I don't want it to stop where it is. I always want more and more people coming out to watch the games. So I hope that can happen. Energy's high, vibes are high. So I think so far, so good.
Beyond this season, many around the club are already thinking much bigger, with longer term goals still including a stadium and eventually a CPL team.
Yeah, so we're still very committed to put a turf field with dome and a stadium in Kingston. We've been working with a landowner for over a year now, and things are moving very well on that front. And we hope to have an announceable shortly, as well as the field up with a year and a bit.
Right now we're in OPL 3, next it's OPL 2, and then hopefully OPL 1. And then after that, if we can see that community growth within soccer, I think soccer's as a whole, it within Canada is growing hugely, especially with the World Cup coming to this summer. But if we can really build on that community, soccer community within Kingston, hopefully next steps is CPL within the city. If we can get that going, that would be amazing. If that community, soccer community, is built within Kingston, and we keep getting promoted and possibly that CPL comes, it's kind of a trickle-down effect. It goes into the grassroots programs and community programs, and it just allows growth within soccer at the youth level to grow at a level we've never seen.
After 10 years without a team at this level, Kingston Soccer has momentum. And for the first time in a long time, players here say they can finally imagine a future in the sport without leaving home. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. To revisit episodes and listen on the go, head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
The following interview was recorded to mark the 20th anniversary of the radio series Wings. 20 years later, we re-release it for our 40th. The very first Wings program was released May 13, 1986. Way back on our 20th anniversary, Jennifer Moore asked about the history of the series.
Wings started when I started to work at Western Public Radio in San Francisco as the operations manager. And I told the guy who was going to hire me, I said, listen, if you're just looking for a secretary, don't hire me, because I had just been fired from a secretarial job because they said I didn't have appropriate clerical demeanor. So anyway, he said, no, I want somebody who'll do projects. I said, really? What kind of projects? He said, anything you want. I said, okay, I'll take the job.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Whatever a clerical demeanor is, it is certainly not what has brought the Women's International News Gathering Service into its 20th year of production. Frieda Weirden, the executive producer of this program, has been reporting on women from a feminist perspective since she began her career as a broadcast journalist in 1973. With a dozen years of broadcast experience behind her, she and the late Catherine Davenport conceived of Wings in San Francisco in 1985. From that time on, Wings has provided a feminist-oriented international broadcast news service following the progress of the global women's movement. Women contributors submit passionate reports from Asia, Africa, Latin America, Australia, Europe, and North America that are then distributed to over 100 stations by CD, satellite service, and now also by digital download. Beyond producing the program, Frieda has remained dedicated to the alternative media movement and to the women's news movement in particular. She's the current president of the International Association of Women in Radio and Television, as well as the vice president for North America with the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters. Having recently moved from Austin, Texas to Vancouver, British Columbia, she also works as the spoken word coordinator at CJSF-FM Campus Community Radio at Simon Fraser University. She was the first recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award of the National Campus Community Radio Association in June in Ottawa. I, like many other women broadcasters, have been inspired by Frieda's tenacity and passion for what she does. As my first contribution to this program, I am excited to share this interview recorded with Frieda in Ottawa, reflecting on the last 20 years of Wings.
So then I was in Washington, D.C. He was in San Francisco. So he called me back an hour later and he said, what kind of projects are you going to do? He was starting to worry. And I said, well, I'm either going to do women's drama or I'm going to do women's news. There was a women's program in New York on WBAI. It was called 51%, the Women's News. And there were two women who were producing that together, and one of them had moved out to the Bay Area about 6 months before I got there. And they were the ones who had gotten me hooked on doing women's news. They'd called me up in Washington and asked me to go cover a story. And I had been doing docudramas before that, and I loved it. And so when I went out there, I looked up Catherine Davenport, And she moved in with me because she was actually homeless at the time. And we started doing a women's news project. This was in 1985 when I got there. You know, it was right at the end of the decade for women. There had been that huge conference in Nairobi, and NPR had refused to send me to the conference. I'd asked them to do it. And at the last minute, they sent 13 reporters, but I had already quit working for them. Let me just say also that there had been a women's news movement that had started within community radio in the United States that I knew about. And also, I knew that there were women who had been doing women's radio and especially news internationally, because in Nairobi there was a peace tent, and the woman who funded the peace tent had called a women's radio meeting there. And from two different sources, when Catherine and I decided to start Wings, we got the list of the women who had been at the peace tent with their contact information. And so we actually managed to get a small grant too, and we used that to contact these women and to, you know, to produce a pilot for the show. So we wrote to the women, and some of them sent things, and then we produced the pilot, and then some more women sent things. And then there was stuff coming in, so Catherine and I decided we would just keep producing it at least once a month until we either couldn't produce it anymore or we got some more money. And we were on the verge of not being able to produce it anymore, and we did get some more money, so we kept it going. But what was behind it was, and behind the whole women's news movement, was, you know, that there was so little about women in the media, and it was so poor. I remember I was watching a television show, current affairs show, called McNeil Lehrer News Hour. They were a very well-known public television show, and they had a man who was doing the interviewing and another man who was a Sovietologist. The interviewer was asking him questions about different people who had been elected to the Politburo of the Soviet Union. And the interviewer says, oh, and there was a woman who was elected. But they said, oh, that was the first woman in 25 years. And before the man could even open his mouth to say anything about her, the interviewer said, oh, and what about so-and-so? And just moved right on and didn't say anything about that woman. So I said, we're going to get something about that woman. I mean, this was a time when Soviets and Americans really weren't allowed to talk to each other. But on International Women's Day, there was a woman who came from the Soviet consulate to speak on International Women's Day. Catherine and I went and recorded the proceedings, and afterwards I got hold of her. I said, listen, we want to get an interview with Alexandra Biryakova. She said, well, here, I'll tell you how to do it. You write to this man. And she came to our office. She sneaked away from her driver and came to our office at Western Public Radio to tell us the details of how to do this. And so we wrote to him, and then suddenly we got a package in the mail. It was an interview with Alexandra Biryakova. The man had said, well, what questions do you want to ask? Send a list of the questions. They had asked all of our questions and translated it and sent it on this little reel. It was so funny because it had a hub that didn't fit on our tape players. We had a hell of a time getting it off so that we could play it, because in Eastern Europe they had a different kind of machinery. But anyway, we had that. We said, we can't not put this on. We're going to have to do another show. But it was so boring that we got a woman who was studying women's studies and specializing in Soviet Union to say some other things around this interview, because otherwise, you know, it wouldn't have been very interesting to listen to at all. But it was pretty amazing.
So it really was international in scope right from the beginning. And can you talk about how the network of contributors and participants in the show grew and just how that took place?
It's been kind of haphazard in a way, you know, just who we could get hold of. Well, one was going to meetings and going to international meetings and meeting women. And another one was women who were reporters got to know what we wanted. They would start to cover that. And another thing, you know, a lot more women are doing spoken word now in radio than used to be, too. The sector has really grown, so that's happening as well. But yeah, as I said, we wrote to all those women who were at that radio meeting, and then we'd also do things like we'd hear about a story that we wanted to get covered, and we'd start looking for somebody to cover it. There was a magazine that came out for a long time from Latin America. It was published out of Chile, called Mujer Femme Press. And I saw a story in there about women in Haiti who were demonstrating in front of, forget what they were demonstrating in front of the radio station, something like that, because that was part of their, they were protesting because women weren't being included in writing the new constitution. So I said, well, let's see if we can get a Haitian woman reporter. And we looked and looked, and finally we got hold of a woman who was a Haitian exile living in Florida, who had all the information about that. And she was a radio producer, and she sent us her report about that. It was very, I just heard her on CBC the other day, actually, Elsie et Dar. She was, so she's still doing radio. One time we just called up the Swedish National Radio and said we wanted to talk to a woman reporter. The woman who answered said, well, I'm a woman reporter. And we said, well, what's the hot news about women in Sweden? She said, well, there's a new American diet plan. We said, no, no, that's not what we mean. And she said, well, actually, there was a story and nobody has covered it. She said, all the women in the parliament from all the different parties got together across party lines to propose a bill that would decriminalize women as prostitutes and criminalize the men who buy the prostitution. So that was a story that we ran very early in Wings. Well, 12 years after that, we ran the story that they had succeeded in passing that bill. And just recently, last year, on Wings, we had a woman who is a spokesperson for the Swedish government who goes around explaining the Swedish prostitution law and how effective it is and how the rest of the countries should follow suit. So it's a story that we've covered from its very inception, you know, up until today when it's being promoted throughout the world.
And what else did you find out when you sort of started scoping around and putting these stories together and inviting these stories? What else were you hearing from other women as you were participating in what you call the women's news movement? Were you finding that there was similar currents everywhere that you went, or was it different?
Well, there certainly are issues that affect women everywhere. But there were some issues that, I mean, when it was started in the United States. Now it's being broadcast from Canada. It's interesting. It gives a different perspective, and I'm very interested in that. But, well, the women in the United States were very isolated, and the Decade for Women had enabled them to meet some women from other countries. And that was one of the main reasons that we started an international program at that time, because they said, you know, these ties have been made and we don't want them to forget what they learned, and we want to use the sympathy that women have developed for each other to try to open up the eyes of people in the United States to the fact that there are other countries and that they have issues, some of which are caused by things that go on in the United States, you know. So that was a piece of it. But the global women's movement has really grown in scope. You know, it has incorporated a lot of different movements over time. And it's been very interesting to see that development, and also to understand that many of the movements that we see today that appear to be led by men were originated by women much earlier. So, for example, the anti-globalization movement. In 1989, I covered a conference, a women's development conference, at which DAWN, Development Alternatives with Women in a New Era, which was a group of intellectual feminists from countries of the South, they took over that conference. It was a conference that took place in the United States, and they took it over, and they laid their vision out, and it has completely changed AWID, Association for Women in Development. They don't even call it the same name anymore. But they were talking about structural adjustment. And that was the first time that I had heard this, how the World Bank would go in and destroy the economy of these countries by forcing people to be laid off from government jobs, by cutting education, by, you know, doing all these things, and how hard this was making life for women. And so women were like kind of canaries in the coal mine, but also there were women intellectuals in the South who were understanding these things and laying them out very early. Another thing that very early came out of the women's movement, well, you know, in 1991, when they had the Summit on the Environment in Rio. Well, the year before that, I think 1990, there were two women's environment conferences that took place in Miami, Florida, international women's environment conferences. And the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet had a tribunal about women and the environment. So this was a moment when the women's movement sort of formally embraced the environment as a feminist issue. And Vandana Shiva was there. She gave the most amazing speech about Terminator seed technology and the attempt to destroy the self-reproducing nature of seeds in order to profit. And, you know, she spoke as a scientist and, you know, with an economic angle as well. It was totally brilliant. I mean, and that was that moment. So we see that the globalization movement, the environmental movement, these kinds of things are coming out of the women's movement. Well, one of the earliest interviews that we had for Wings was an interview with Helen Caldicott talking about how the Physicians for Social Responsibility had forced her out of the organization shortly before they won the Nobel Prize. So you can see that there is a problem of who gets the credit for stuff. Yeah. But yes, by following women's ideas throughout the world, listening to what they have to say, I mean, it's just such an incredible education that I've been able to get and to share with other people. It's amazing.
What has changed for the program or changed now that it's coming from the vantage point of being produced in Canada?
Well, one of the things I think about for the American audience, and of course, it's not just American, we're in New Zealand. I have to keep thinking they don't like to hear too much about America and New Zealand. If I have too many in a row, they'll threaten to cancel. And, you know, we're in Australia and a number of other countries. But I think that it's very important for the Americans to hear other ideas about what's a normal society. The normal positions in Canadian society are a fair bit different than the United States society, and may they stay that way, you know. But things like a woman who did a piece about cooperative housing. Cooperative housing is much more normal, and all kinds of co-ops are much more normal in Canada than they are in the United States. Or, like, there was a piece that we got from a producer in Victoria about Canadian women's dialogue about abortion. Well, because abortion is not under such threat here, I mean, the dialogue was much more far-reaching. They were able to talk about issues like wanting to debrief after an abortion and to say, you know, the parts that you felt bad about, even though you wouldn't have wanted to not have the abortion, and other missing pieces that are there, where in the U.S. with abortion under such threat, women are afraid to even say anything negative about their experience. They can't really talk about their real experience in public because it's so, everything's being used against them.
How broad is the distribution for Wings?
It's on a lot of community stations. And we used to try to distribute to public radio, but we gave up on that because in the United States, our tone of voice was wrong for public radio. They didn't want to hear any kind of passion. Marshall McLuhan said, you know, radio is the hot medium and television is medium cool. But NPR in the United States has turned radio into a cool medium. And so, you know, it's like NPR News and jazz, NPR News and classical music, and even they don't want to use anything from a public address. And once I really understood that we couldn't be what we were and promote to them, I just quit promoting to them entirely. So now I'm only promoting to community radio.
On Wings, you're listening to an interview about the origins of this series. Recorded for our 20th anniversary, it is now released for our 40th.
We send out a little over 50 CDs, but then we have subscribers on two satellite services, and we don't even really know how many we've got because we don't get much feedback. We're on a satellite service in the U.S. and one in Australia. And then we have downloading subscribers. And I'm really wanting to get some kind of situation so that we'll know who downloaded it, because right now we don't really have any way to track that. I think it'd be safe to say around 100 stations worldwide. And we certainly could use a lot more promotion. I like to say the coverage that Wings does of women and women's issues is really just a drop in the bucket of what is needed. But at least if there's a drop in the bucket, you know what water is.
Just to give people understanding, how sizable is the operation to put Wings together?
Well, we actually have, at the moment, two rooms in my house, one of which is under threat. I'm being told I should really consolidate into one room. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's being produced out of a spare bedroom, but the producers are in many places. And finally, about a year ago, we started a listserv for Wings producers. So the producers started getting dialogue with each other. So, like, there's a woman from Ghana who's on the list, and, you know, these are kind of more active members. There's a woman from India who's on the list, from Bangalore. And then one in California and one in Halifax. And, you know, I mean, it's a weekly half hour is what it is. So that's really not very much time. 52 half hours a year. And, I mean, there's still room for more reporters. We need to raise a little bit more money because I'm paying the reporters. I've been paying them ever since it started because we felt that women should be paid for their work because mainly just to say that it's valuable because women are asked to do work for free so much. Yeah, we spend about $8,000 a year in royalties to producers. And that's our primary expense.
And in terms of the listserv and just in terms of what networking has happened as a result of the program, is there much dialogue that's happening between those producers?
There could be more. What we need next is a content sharing depot. You know, one where we could dump our raw material and then work on things together. You know, like I'd like it to develop more into a virtual newsroom. Before I moved to Canada, we were starting to get kind of a good core group going in Texas. And some of those women are still active with Wings, but I really miss that in Vancouver, that I don't have anybody like who's coming in to produce in-house. You know, I've had a few people, but maybe the virtual newsroom in this day and age is really the way to do it. So somebody can say, well, I have some audio about such and such, and someone else can say, well, I have some time to edit, because the editing is extremely time-consuming. I mean, for me, even after all these years, I spend an average of 20 hours per half hour.
You've done a lot of international work through a number of international associations, the Association for Community Radio Broadcasters at the international level, amongst others. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit on that in terms of what your experience has been with the women's news movement and the importance of communication rights at an international level to the advancement of women's voices and women's access and coverage of important information for or by women.
Well, that's a really big order. There's some very interesting organizations, like there's one with a very innocuous name called the Women's Learning Partnership, that is actually a collaboration of women across the Muslim world to do communication through the internet. And they produced a film which we turned into a documentary. Actually, there's a woman from Pakistan who did the re-edit of the film. I mean, they need to have that right because, I mean, they're kind of like sort of a sub rosa movement, but it's very important for them that they have the right to communicate through all media and across borders, as it says in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 19, you know, because they are in a struggle for their rights in some of those places. So that's a piece of it. Yes, women are marginalized in the global communication rights movement, and yet from the margins have done so much. I mean, they're coming from margin to center all the time. Women have brought forth a tremendous amount within, like, the World Summit on the Information Society process. The whole civil society movement was very largely done by women. Sally Birch came up with the Civil Society Declaration, which was a negotiated document among many different sectors of civil society about what the information society should be for them. So, yeah, women and feminist women are very active in these things. And feminist media women have been able to get together through these international events like the UN World Conferences on Women, and at the United Nations, the Commission on the Status of Women meets now every year, and so forth. But at the same time, communications have been marginalized within the United Nations process and within that movement. You know, the Beijing Declaration, which came out of the 1995 United Nations World Conference on Women in China, mentioned women's media rights. It was the first time in 20 years since 1975 that media had really gotten into the document. But at the same time, it was a rather weak plank. And one of the reasons was because China definitely did not support access to, you know, women's independent access to media. I mean, they believe that the state should control the media, and they do control it very tightly. And in fact, in their version of the Beijing Declaration, they didn't even mention the communication rights. Now, the United States, on the other hand, believes that freedom of the press belongs to those who own the press. And when we talked to their delegation, they didn't want to talk about it. And in fact, when President Clinton formed his a White House committee that he made out of women from different sectors of government who were going to be a counsel for him and advise the White House, he did not invite any women from the Federal Communications Commission, for example, to be a part of that group. And when they talked about which planks of the 12 or 13 planks of the Beijing Platform for Action they would move on, they said, well, we don't have time to do all of them, and so they only chose like five. So with that kind of resistance, on the one hand, the state against you, on the other hand, the private sector against you, it's hard to find a space. And even as recently as the Beijing Plus 10 in 2005, Mavic Cabrera Baeza, who is, among other things, she's the vice president for Women of AMARC, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, she was supposed to make a talk about women in media to the Commission on the Status of Women, and somehow they ran out of time, or her name wasn't on the list or something. She wasn't allowed to speak about that issue. So deliberately or accidentally, there's a lot of marginalization. The other thing is that the women's movement, certainly in the United States and also in Canada, they're paranoid about the press. On the one hand, they're paranoid about the mainstream press, I think with good reason. But on the other hand, they've been all along pretty disrespectful of the feminist media. It's as if it doesn't exist, or it's beneath. If it's not the New York Times, they don't have respect for it. And so one of the things that I've been working on for a while, quite a long time actually, is to try to get the feminist movement organizations to accept and appreciate alternative media. And just a year ago, I was on a panel. The Canadian Association of Sexual Assault Centers had a conference in Vancouver, and they had actually was two panels. It was interesting. One of them was a panel of media women talking to frontline workers, and the other one was a panel of frontline workers talking to media women. And I thought it was very well organized, because first, the media women, we sat through this panel that was directed at us, and we heard about what their fears were about the media. And then we did our panel, and we talked to them about what kind of media we were. And among other things, I talked about the issue of bias. I said, and you are allowed to have a bias, but you have to acknowledge that the other side exists. You know, you can't, this is a CRTC regulation about an issue of public controversy. I said, but you don't have to give them equal time. You don't have to agree with their arguments. But, you know, breaking through that fear and that sense that media is not for you, you know, it's a process, and it's a slow damn process. I mean, I've been doing radio about women since 1973, and I'm still finding, you know, we haven't made the progress that we want to in terms of, I mean, why aren't women flocking to the community radio stations? Half the airtime should be women, and yet we find that in almost any station, no matter how hard you try, it's really, really hard to get past about 33 or 35% of women on the air. Come on, step up. It's here. You can have it. We want you to have it. It's waiting for you. We'll show you everything. Anyway, that's my message.
For the Women's International News Gathering Service, this has been Frida Weirden, the executive producer of this program. This is Jennifer Moore, reporting from Guelph, Ontario, Canada.
That interview about the origins of Wings was recorded for our 20th anniversary and re-released for our 40th. Our longevity is due to the work of many contributing producers and supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughan, whose works can be viewed through the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. To find more about Wings, visit wings.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
When the clock strikes midnight, the night truly begins. Step into the darkness on CFRC's Retro Radio Show, diving deep into the sounds of the past, from haunting classics to underground gems. This is DJ Terry, and every Friday night at midnight till 2 a.m., tune your dial to 101.9 or CFRC.ca and let the music pull you in.
By muddy.